This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Telos Systems. Telos Audio and Networks, the best way to hear from there. On the web at telos-systems.com. And by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations. On the web at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt. A beautiful F-111 fighter aircraft came skimming, only being less than 20 meters above the top of the tower.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
It's a War Stories episode with Andy Linton, Peter Smearden from Australia, and Chris Tobin from New York City.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hello, I'm Kirk Harnack, and very glad to have you with us. I'm your host for the show, and we have a co-host with us. That would be Chris Tobin from New York City. Hi, Chris.
Kirk, how are you?
I'm good. It's good to see you. I understand you just got done from crawling under a studio or something.
Yes, we just relocated our filing position at New York City City Hall to a trailer out in City Hall Park while they renovate portions of City Hall building, which need it dearly because it's over 100 years old and has a lot of warts.
I'm not sure which that you said a filing location. So this is where a reporter files stories. But it sounds like a trailer outside of City Hall in New York may just be a more desirable location than City Hall. But if they're going to remodel it, then that'll be good afterwards. Hey, let's check in with two of our guests here. One of our guests is in Ireland, where it's dark 30. It's Andy Linton in Waterford, Ireland. No, that's Peter. How about Andy? Hey, Andy, how you doing?
Yeah. Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. It's just 6 after 1 here. Very dark outside.
I would say so. Hey, lean in towards your mic a little bit. I know you said you couldn't get an external mic for the show, but you sound like you're... There you go. Show your pretty face up closer. And Andy is a contract engineer with a company called Total Broadcast Consultants. Andy, tell us just a sentence or two about what you guys do there in Ireland.
Well, I guess we could be called a systems integrator and a broadcast technical consultant. That's it, really. We hawk ourselves around to anyone who wants to start a new radio station, someone who might want to remodel a facility or put a new transmitter on the air. We can do anything from acoustic rooms all the way through to transmitter sites. That's why we call ourselves Total.
Well, and I've been at a few sites with you in Athlone. We're looking at a studio that you guys are building. And then, as I recall, we went to a transmitter site that, oh, my goodness, seemed like the middle of absolutely nowhere. Does that transmitter site have any listeners?
I'm trying to remember which transmitter site that was, Kirk.
It was on the West Coast.
Oh, that was Clifton. That's right over in the west of Connemara in Ireland. And that was a transmitter site up on a mountain which... half of it appears to overlook the Atlantic Ocean. But that does have some very important listeners. That's a kind of an Irish speaking part of the country, not entirely Irish speaking, but a lot of Irish speaking people in that part of, let's say, I suppose, Western Ireland. So yeah, it's a very important place. And that transmitter there does have quite a lot of listeners. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, there were none right near the transmitter. I just remember miles and miles of peat as we drove all the way up to
site.
And, peat and sheep. Hey, also joining us from down under where it's morning, let's say good morning to Peter Smearden. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi, Kirk. Pretty well. And yourself?
I'm doing great. Good to see you. We had you on a show back in December when we were an audio-only podcast. So this is the first chance we've had to look at you.
There you go, then. Now you can see it. Now you probably wish you hadn't.
Well, I'm really glad to have you on, Peter, because I know you have some war stories to tell. Peter, am I correct in saying that you're a mostly retired broadcast engineer?
Yeah, mostly retired. I do a little bit of radio stuff, RF and studio stuff from time to time, primarily to help out people I've worked with before. But I'm largely taking it easy now and enjoying life far more than I ever have.
Well, you've been a good commenter on the show on our various episodes, bringing up good topics for us to talk about. And I know you've got a wealth of experience there in Australia, a lot of that with AM transmitters. So there can be a lot of scary incidents going on with AM transmitters as well. So, hey, let's jump right into it. And I will begin the festivities with just a small war story of my own. And then we'll hand it off to whoever jumps in next with a war story. This was... this must have been in the mid-1980s, maybe late 1980s. Oh, good golly. About 1990, I suppose. I was living in Memphis and running Harnack Engineering, where we did engineering for almost 100 radio stations around the mid-south part of the U.S. And I was called to go to Boyle, Mississippi, B-O-Y-L-E, Boyle, Mississippi, a town that later in life, I would end up calling my home address, actually, as I lived outside of Boyle, Mississippi. But I was called to go to a little radio station, Boyle, Mississippi, WRDC, if you care to look that up. And the station had a little tower out behind the studio building. The studio was in a shotgun type of two-story brick business building in downtown Boyle, Mississippi. They had this little tower. It was made of Rhone 25. If you know broadcast engineers, we all know what Rhone 25 is. It's some lightweight tower, maybe should go up to 100 feet or so with an antenna on it, and maybe 200 feet, a standalone tower with guy wires and such. Well, this one was a self-supporting Rhone 25 that some jackleg had put up, and me being young, inexperienced, and full of himself, decided that I could climb this tower and go repair or reorient the antenna, the 950 megahertz STL antenna that was up on top of it. So I put my climbing belt on, which was probably the safest thing in the area, and proceeded to climb up this tower. Now, this tower wasn't guyed. It was the bottom section was just in the ground. Turned out it wasn't even in concrete in the ground. It was just stuck in the ground. Somebody dug a hole, put the bottom section in, put the dirt back in, and tamped it down. It may have had a bracket from the roof line of the building supporting the little tower at some point. So I started climbing this tower, and I'm climbing up and up this tower with my climbing belt, and I'm looking at the STL antenna that's above me. It was a Scala PR 950, may have been a PR 450 at the time, but I was climbing up to this antenna. It's about 5 feet wide. This antenna kind of looks like a metal lounge chair. Bolted to the tower. So I'm climbing up and climbing up and climbing up, and pretty soon I realized that the tower is no longer quite vertical. In fact, the tower is bending in the direction of the weight, which was me. And so I look straight down, and my goodness, I'm a good 5 or 8 feet off of the center of where the tower is planted. And so the tower is curved and bending over. If you're watching us on video, you can see it doing like this. And I thought, well, why is the tower doing this? Okay, I expect a little bit of bend, but this is nuts. And I looked down every section. You know, the tower just pushes together. One section just pushes onto another, and there's room for two bolts on each leg of the tower. So I looked down the tower, and it quickly occurred to me that there were no bolts in the tower. None whatsoever. It was just stacked, one section on top of the other, with absolutely nothing else holding the sections. How the guy ever put the antenna up there to begin with, I don't know. Maybe they had a guy on each side of the tower balancing out the load. So I quickly scampered down and learned my lesson and went to the hardware store and bought some bolts. And I installed a bolt on each leg at each tower section all the way up, and finally got up to the point where I could reorient the antenna. So, all right. That's my little war story for the first part of the show. Who's going to jump in next?
Much wind in Boyle.
What's that?
They mustn't have much wind in Boyle.
No, most of the wind probably came from the governor, mayor's office.
Yeah, I've actually got a tower climbing story of my own. As a youngster, first job at a radio station in Brisbane, Australia, it was as a bit of trivia, it was actually the first directional antenna system built in Australia. It was on the edge of Moreton Bay. And the engineer decided that to get the best coverage, because he'd been over to America and seen DAs in America, and this is back in the early 50s, so he set up a two-tower DA with a cardioid pattern so that none of the signal was lost over the water. And so it's a two-tower, but unfortunately it was fairly close to the airport, which meant that the towers had to be fairly short and well lit. And so a regular occurrence was to clamber up the towers and change beacon lamps because the airport was very, very nervous about any lamps being out. And so one day, and this was probably about the second time I'd actually climbed the tower, I'm clambering up the tower, and this is actually my second attempt at climbing a tower, because I hadn't done climbing before this job. I'd been a studio tech at radio stations and never had to worry about transmitters. So I'm clambering up the tower, trying to figure out how to do it safely without falling off, and to keep the harness in place and all of that, with a bag of beacon lamps over my shoulder. And I'm just get up to the top of the tower. It was one of the top beacons I had to change. And then all of a sudden, this almighty roar came, and right across the top of me, a beautiful F-111 fighter aircraft came skimming, and I would guess that it would only have been less than 20 metres above the top of the tower. It was everything I could do not to fall off the tower. This was back in the early 70s, I think it was, Australia had just purchased these beautiful F-111 fighter aircraft from the US, those swing-wing jobs, and I found out later that our towers were one of their bombing targets that they used to use for bombing runs on a regular basis. Oh, I had to change my underpants after that.
Oh, gee. Reminds me of that movie, Pushing Tin, where the guys would make a game of standing at the very threshold of the runway, and the big jets would, you know, flip them over from the wind swirling around. But you're on the tower, and this thing goes over. Holy moly!
Yes.
Gee. So I guess these towers must. Well, was the F-111 flying a lot lower than it should have been? Was the guy hot dogging, or were you really this close to the path?
No, I think, well, these things, I think they were the first aircraft that had ground-hugging radar, and so these were aircraft that routinely flew literally just single-digit metres above the terrain, typically. And so I think that he was flying at his normal bombing run height. He was attempting to bomb our towers.
That's something else. Did you ever try coordinating with the airport? Was this guy talking to the airport? Was he? I guess he would have been if he was right in the vicinity of the airport.
Yeah.
I guess my point is it worthwhile to try to coordinate that so that that doesn't happen again, or you know, you just take your chances. Yeah. I guess they're not going to hit you.
No, I didn't. I didn't experience it again, but I figured after the first time, I would know what to expect. But it was just the surprise element of it that nearly knocked me sideways.
Yeah. Wow. So, Andy Linton, are you you with us here? Did you fall asleep there in Ireland?
No, not at all. Although wouldn't take very much right now. But listen to tower stories. That's the kind of thing that I think you kind of instinctively stay awake for. Yeah. I mean, I've read some tales of some guys in the States who have climbed some of the really high towers you have in the States. I think I was reading a tale of a guy who wrote a very nice prosaic account of what it was like to climb a 2,000-foot tower. And we don't really get towers that big in this part of the world. But I remember this guy, I think I read it on the internet long ago, and he wrote this very nice account of, you know, he started at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was, you know, midday before he really got to the top and was ready to do the work. And that's the sort of thing that you've really got to stay awake. Tower climbing is not something I've ever really done much of. These days, I only do it if I really had to. It's not something I would enjoy doing at all. I had to put a microwave link dish up on a tower that we look after a few weeks ago, because there was no riggers available, so I had to do it. And it wasn't very high. But luckily, the tower we were using was a freestanding tower, and I was able to climb up the inside. And strangely enough, I felt pretty safe climbing up the inside of the tower. but there was no way I was going to climb up the outside. So I was quite happy climbing up the inside of it. But that was last week. That now, I don't know, maybe 25 years ago when I started my career in radio, we used to do some pretty silly things. We were young, you know, and stupid, and a lot lighter than we are now, which kind of helps.
And surely indestructible as well.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. Nothing was going to hurt us. I mean, for example, I remember one radio station, myself and my colleague Andy Green used to work on. This would have been in the early 80s, and the outside the studio of the radio station, we had a, okay, this is not very high in the general scheme of things, but it was about a 100-foot mast, not a tower, a mast, a 2-inch diameter steel pole. Are you familiar with the construction of that sort of arrangement? So supported maybe every 10 feet by 4 guy wires, which go off to the anchor points. But it consists of a circular section pole, which I guess it's about 2.5 inches outside diameter. And in order to climb that, you'd attach these strange kind of climbing shoes to your feet, and you'd kind of shimmy then up the mast. And, of course, when you get to a point where the stay wires come off, you have to step off the pole and then step back on again. Now, wow. You know, we'd seen a rigger doing this, and he had these metal shoes. And we thought, well, this is good. We'll get some of those made. So down we went to the local guy that did the welding and kind of described to him and that the way they locked onto the towel was that they were made, the front part of the shoe was made of a very large threaded nut, which was cut in half vertically, and one half was mounted, if you like, above the other, like that. So you would incline your foot, pop it onto the pole, and then when you lean back, the screw threads would lock. Sure. So we got these made, and of course, you know, they weren't exactly how they should have been. So we just used to tie them on with a bit of string onto our feet. So it wasn't unknown for you to be, you know, maybe 50 feet in the air, and one of them would fall off. Which is kind of bad news, because you either had to get the guy on the ground to tie it back onto the rope that you pulled up with you and haul it back up and put it back on your foot while you're up there. Meanwhile, of course, all your weight is on one leg. Or you just kind of shimmy down using one. So that was pretty hairy. And then, of course, in those days, you know, if we had a safety harness on, well, then, you know, then that was a kind of a rare occasion. But there were times when we were rigging antennas on the top of this pole where we said, well, we really should have a safety harness. Now, we ended up with a harness. I don't think you really could have attached the word safety to it, because it was made out of blue nylon rope. And I think back to that now, and I think, geez, you know, I can remember one day at Christmas in the driving snow. I mean, the snow was sideways. This site was on the coast, so there was a coastal wind blowing. Something had happened to one of the antennas, and I was up there for 3 hours just with a piece of nylon rope holding me on and these homemade climbing shoes. And, of course, when I came down, the whole of one side of my body all the way down here was covered in ice, from my hair all the way down over my ear. One side was all completely covered in ice that had to be peeled off. And, you know, the things we did.
I thought I was the only one stupid enough or determined enough to climb a tower during essentially a freezing rain sleet storm.
Yeah. It has to be done. Keep the station on the air.
Well, you know, but you look back and you wonder, gee, is it really that important, the station to be on the air? If I had died, would that have been worthwhile for the, you know, all, I don't know, 1,500 of our listeners that day? This is not New York City I was working in, and we'll get to Chris Tobin in just a minute. This is not New York City. This was, in this case, it was Greenville, Mississippi, just across the river, actually, near a lake. And I was climbing the tower on, actually, it was Christmas Eve day. No, it wasn't. It was a New Year's Eve day in a driving sleet and freezing rainstorm, such that by the time I came down, indeed, half of my body, in this case, it was pretty much the front half, was covered with frozen rain. And I had been 175 feet in the air repairing a splice in the STL cable. We didn't have enough I guess it was 1.25-inch coax. So we had to splice it to some half-inch coax. And there was a female and a male connection there somewhere in the middle, and one of them was faulty, and so I had to go up there and fix it that day. But oh my gosh, that takes every ounce of energy out of you to climb that thing, then to stand there in the freezing rain and 20-mile-an-hour winds or more, while your fingers are out, because you can't work on this stuff with gloves. It's just too hard, too difficult. And then you're wielding a knife up there, cutting through the tape and the old stuff. Meanwhile, you've got a brand new connector in your pocket, and you're going to attach this connector. It's going to be a solderless kind of connector. And you know what? If you drop one little part from that kit of parts, then you know it's all over, because you're not going to find it in the bean field below. And you're not going to want to go get it and come and go back up. So every single movement is very well. You almost feel like you know what the astronauts who are working on the Hubble telescope or the space station must feel like. Although if they drop apart, you may have a chance of retrieving it before it floats away, but not up a tower and not by yourself.
And Kirk, isn't it a funny thing that the simplest, smallest little thing you have to do when you're doing that sort of work is 100 times harder when you're up a mast or up a tower than it is if you're on the ground. You know, putting one of those connectors on, you do that in 5 minutes. It's easy. You wouldn't drop any parts. But up there, it becomes really difficult.
You are so right. And that led me to an appreciation of tower climbers, that if I'm on the ground, taking care of turning the transmitter on or off, or sending instructions or relaying instructions to or from some guys with radios on the tower, you know what? The number one priority of the guys on the ground need to be, what are the needs of the guys on the tower? Because they are up there doing work that is really tough to do in an environment where if they make a mistake, number one, it could be fatal. Number two, they could drop a wrench on somebody on the ground. So you want to be sure you're listening for anybody to say heads up. And really, your attention needs to be focused on those guys. Just a word out there for station managers and station engineers who are working with the tower crew. Those guys that are 200 feet or 2,000 feet in the air are the guys that deserve your absolute attention.
Uh-huh.
So it's Chris Tobin with us. Hey, Chris.
I'm here. Good evening, everyone.
You've got a little bit different tower situation there in New York City compared to some of the flat parts of the U.S., the flyover states, and some places, I suppose, in Ireland or in Australia. What are some of your tower experiences in New York City?
Let's see. One of my tower locations is the Empire State Building, so that in itself is a unique situation. Sure, it's not a 10-foot face or a 5-foot face tower and three sides to it or not. No guy wires to speak of, thank goodness. However, climbing out on the top of the ice bridge at the base of the master antenna system at 2 o'clock in the morning is a very harrowing moment in your life. You stand there looking out onto the city of New York, the Hudson River, and you're about 1,300 feet above sea level.
Is the view just splendidly gorgeous at that time?
I would do it every time. The view is absolutely the best you'll see. At first, when you step out on the ice bridge, by the way, is about 2 feet wide. It's a little catwalk, perforated steel walkway with a small railing made out of chain link material, and approximately 10 feet of building around you. So you can almost see to the other side of the Empire State Building at the very base of the master antenna, the mooring mast. So you can see around the edge, and you're sort of like, wow. We're out there trying to troubleshoot a problem we had with a leak, and working with the tower crews. So I had an opportunity to go out there, and you can't pass that up. You know, when somebody says, "Hey, would you like to go out on the ice bridge and see what things look like from the base of the tower, the mooring mast, I should say," you go up there.
That would be my dream. I would love to do that. I hope you have some trouble next time I'm in New York, and we can go up there together. There's probably some insurance reason why I can't, though.
You never know. There's a lot of work going on up there. We could always probably make arrangements in advance. But it's fun because you're going up into the base where the ironwork, the struts that are designed to support the mooring mast are. And that's the original ironwork that was for the dirigibles that were supposed to be, moored there for people to for transportation.
My follow-up question is, please explain to us what the mooring mast on the Empire State Building is. And are the antennas actually above this mast or below it? What part of the structure is the mooring mast?
Well, the mooring mast, when you see the New York City skyline, the very top of the Empire State Building, it's tapered, as you know, when you see the top. So it's that long, a tall, thin line, if you're looking at a picture. That is the mooring mast. That's the antenna mast. The mooring mast position is at the base of that dome, the very top of the building structure before it becomes a pin-shaped vertical line. And the mooring mast is where the dirigibles or blimps were going to be tied to for passengers to step off onto a plank, a gangway, if you will, and into the building. However, they discovered that the updraft from the building caused that balloon-like structure, the blimp, to sort of become a vertical type thing. So it didn't go very well. If you ever watch when the Goodyear blimp is landing at a field, you notice there's a lot of folks pulling it, and it doesn't seem very forgiving. Right. Picture that at 1,300 feet above a city. It just doesn't go. But you got to give me credit.
You know. How would you have walked from the door of the blimp to someplace on the Empire State Building? Would there have been a gangplank?
The picture that I looked at, it was, yes, a gangplank. They had, there was designed the mooring mast mechanism, the ropes or the cables would bring the cage. No, there's a name for the bucket where you ride beneath the actual blimp itself or the balloon structure. Gondola. Thank you. The gondola. That's brought close to the base. And then there's a gangway that comes out and you walk down. Yeah, that's basically it. It's as simple as it sounds. But to be able to go up there and look at it, it's really cool. It really is.
Here's another little war story for you. It's just a rumor. I didn't see this with my own eyes. But speaking of the Empire State Building, there is a radio station, an FM station, that operates from the top of the Empire State Building, as quite a few do. And it would be a good thing if the engineer for that station would check the tightness of the bolts of the RF plumbing. Because I heard a rumor that an engineer for a competing station at one time loosened some of those bolts. So somebody may want to
check in on that, huh?
A rumor.
Well, you know, in the old days, the old diplexing system was on different levels inside the upper structure of the building where the lights are, where the different color lights that you see. But nowadays, the new antenna system, it's in one room, it's secured, and there's no chance of that taking place. But, I'll take a look into that. I'll find out more.
You know, on a previous show, we threatened or promised to give some URLs to photos of that combining room at the Empire State Building, the FM combiner room. And I may have promised to do that. I've got some old photos somewhere. Chris, do you know of any website that's got some photos of that? If so, I'd love to put that on the show notes so folks can see that monstrosity of plumbing.
I will have to check. Scott Feibusch should have something. If he doesn't on his site, I will have to look and see. There are some folks with it. I'll find out.
All right. That'd be cool. Hey, let's bring it back around to our neighbor to the south in Australia, Peter Smerdon. Peter, you were telling me earlier that you've got some war stories from remote locations. You know, radio stations so often will go out and do a live broadcast at a remote location, that is outside the studio, either from what they call everywhere in the world, they call it this, but not in the U.S., an OB van, an outside broadcast van, or maybe you set up at a car dealership or a sports venue or something like that. Peter, you got some a harrowing story or two from a remote broadcast, right?
Yep. Most of the remotes that I've done have been fairly simple ones, although towards the latter part of my career they did get a bit more complicated. But the typical remote, for example, an FM radio station might be a trestle table with a couple of jocks and feeding down a Comrex or a Vector or something like that. Monitoring via a boombox and being fed into a local PA system. At the FM stations I worked with on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland, they used to do a lot of these. Now, they were all sales based. They would sell a client on doing a a live broadcast from their venue. One of the big clients for this particular pair of radio stations was the Australia Zoo, the home of Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter, because that was just down the road from us, maybe a 15-minute drive from the radio station. And they would often do outside broadcasts because Australia Zoo was very promotionally oriented, and they'd had any excuse and they'd run some kind of a promotion, ads in the papers and live broadcasts from the radio stations, and try to get the television news crews there and all of that sort of thing. And I was doing one Saturday afternoon. It was a typical remote. We had the couple of jocks on. One of them happened to be a surfing mate of Steve Irwin's, and so it was good rapport. Steve was there and his mate Darren Landers, and they were swapping surfing stories, because funnily enough, Steve actually he surfed in his khakis. None of the board shorts for him. It was his khaki shorts that you always saw him in. That was what he surfed in. But it was a good OB. It went very well. And as usual, at the end of the OB, everybody disappears and I'm there packing up. And it's about between 6 and 7 o'clock in the evening on a Saturday evening. And I'm packing up and suddenly I look around. All of the lights have gone out. This is in an open area alongside the main crocodile enclosure. And look around. There's absolutely nobody there. The park had shut and all of the staff had disappeared. And I'm there and I look over and there is the biggest crocodile I have ever seen watching me intently through the chain link fence, watching everything that I was doing.
Through the chain link right fence.
Fortunately, it was the other side of the chain link fence. But
okay.
It didn't look too secure, a chain link fence. And I'm watching this monster who'd sort of clambered up the bank from his pond, and he's watching everything that I'm doing. At that point, I got out of there as fast as I could. Oh, that was a scary moment. Just the realization when I looked around and saw the crocodile, who oddly enough was called Graham. They had some strange names for their animals there. It was Rosie the Python, Graham the crocodile, but just that moment of realization when I looked through the fence and saw him watching me intently, like, oh, here's dinner. And that set me back. But the other thing that set me back was a few months later there was a bad flood at Australia Zoo, and Steve Irwin nearly lost his life because all of the ponds got flooded, and Steve was there trying to get the crocodiles all moved out of the flooded ponds, and Graham attacked him. So the same crocodile is actually taken on the crocodile hunter only a couple of months after he'd been in essence stalking me. So that's remote or outside broadcast story number one. And then I guess the other one, which is a little bit more prosaic, is that with the same radio stations, there was an OB that never happened. We had we fed the two radio stations from a downtown location. We fed the signals by radio link up to the mountain that the transmitters were on, and there were two link paths, one via a repeater station and one direct, and there was a thunderstorm, a bad thunderstorm one night, and it took out one of the repeater sites, the repeater site link receiver, so we were running on just the secondary link, that went directly from the station to the transmitter, and it started playing up on a on a Saturday morning, and you wouldn't know it, that Saturday morning I had a scheduled outside broadcast for one of the stations. It was a big outside broadcast, and I had to abandon that broadcast because I had to take the Comrex equipment that I was that we was due to use for the outside broadcast and use it to replace the two faulty links that we had for the other station. So that was an outside broadcast that never happened because the equipment had to be reassigned in a hurry to keep the other, ironically, the other station on the air. So the broadcasts don't always go smoothly when you move out of the studios.
Yeah, and especially when you have to take the equipment you would have done the broadcast with just to keep your station on the air. I'm sure exactly. Plenty of folks have done that. I've certainly been at stations where we used the RPU gear, that is like the Marti brand gear to keep the station on the air because the studio transmitter link died. And so we couldn't do any outside broadcast during that time. You have to put to use all the stuff that you have. It's sometimes being a broadcast engineer is a bit like one of these these computer games where you go around, you collect up all the little things you can, and you use them to get to the next level. It's a bit like that. If you had a problem at the station, you got to figure out, well, what do I have to solve this problem with? Oh, I have this Comrex gear here. Maybe I can keep the station on over a phone line or over an IP link. Or I've got this remote pickup gear that operates at 150 megahertz, and usually we use it for broadcast from the car dealer, but we're going to use it to keep on the air, keep the station on the air, and just not be able to do the live broadcast or do it by cell phone nowadays or some other means like that. So yeah. We have to be pretty resourceful in those cases. Hey, Andy, you've got a remote outside broadcast story too. What's up with that?
Well, I was just thinking there, listening to Peter, that when I was a station engineer, I'd get a phone call sometime, and there'd be the sales guy would say, "Hey, Andy, we've got an outside broadcast lined up." And first of all, my heart would sink just a little anyway, just the words "outside broadcast," these salespeople, they just have no idea or no thought about how difficult it might be to get the signal back from there. You know, I mean, Andy, we could do an outside broadcast from a pit 20 feet in the ground lined with new metal. Is that okay? That's the sort of thing these guys
I did that
with.
Remote. I did.
Yeah.
I swear, you finish in a second. I was the engineer for a few years for WKQQ, Double Q FM, 98.1 at the time in Lexington, Kentucky. Now it's the Bull or something else like that, and the call letters Double Q has moved somewhere else. But I swear, every this was a rock station, and they would sell a lot of bar remotes, right? Friday afternoon, Friday evening, bar remote. So every Friday afternoon, the whole station would go down to this bar, and they usually sold it to some bar that was in the basement of a hotel downtown Lexington, Kentucky. And there's no chance of getting an RF signal out of there whatsoever. So it was always a conglomeration of, okay, we'll run this wire out up the stairs, tape it down as far as it'll go, and then we'll use the wireless mic from there to go just up the next flight of stairs and outside to the truck that we've got parked on the street where we'll receive the wireless mic signal. And then we can't get a straight shot to the station, so we'll bounce the 450 megahertz signal off of that skyscraper, and maybe it'll hit our tower at the studio site. And lo and behold, it would work. Just amazing.
But then you've got to worry about your return audio.
We didn't have return. We listened to the radio for that. It was before the digital age, so stuff was pretty live on the air, and it wasn't a big problem. But yeah, you're right. Just picking the station up could be a bit of an issue sometimes. I'm sorry, Andy. I didn't mean to jump in front of you there, but you said a Mu Metal room underground. Been there, done that. Didn't get the T-shirt.
Oh, yeah. These sales guys, they seek those out. No, my story that I was going to tell you was actually 1 year ago this weekend. There's a big rock festival happens in Ireland every year. It's probably the biggest one all year. It's called Oxygen. It's on. It starts tomorrow. So last year, I was contracted by a station to go to the festival grounds and set up the OB for two stations. One of the stations you've been to, Kirk. So I got there nice and early, I think on the Friday morning, and there's pass, isn't that, to get in. It's a load of hassle to get in and a load of hassle to get out because you have to go backstage, and you can imagine what these big rock festivals are like actually moving around within the venue itself, which is huge. So eventually, I get to the place where the little cabins are for the, they had a little, what did they call it? A little broadcast village where all the radio stations that were coming from the venue were all situated. So eventually I get on, I unload the equipment, and there's a few girls from the radio station there, the promotional staff from the radio station were there already. So the first thing I did was I took the ISDN codec into the small little cabin and plugged that into the power outlet in the wall. And the lights are all on in there, so the power was on, so plugged it in. Then I went out to my car to get the rest of the equipment. One of the promo girls came out, and she said, Andy, there's some smoke coming out of that box of yours. So I said, oh, well, that's not a good thing. So I went back in, and there was, I wouldn't say some smoke, there was clouds of smoke coming out of the ISDN codec. If you ever, I don't know if you've ever had a capacitor, an electrolytic capacitor, you know, when they pop, there's lots of smoke. And yes. There was smoke billowing out of this ISDN codec. And at that moment, the program director of the radio station arrived, and he said, hey, what's going on? That's not good, is it? I said, no, that's really not good. That's really not a good thing. I mean, the smoke, I mean, we'd pulled the power from out of the outlet at this stage. The smoke was still coming out. So I said, well, that's okay. That's annoying. That's a really annoying coincidence, that is. You know, the power supply in the ISDN codec decides to go pop on the day when the radio station is going to do the most important outside broadcast of the year. So I took the lid off the codec, and sure enough, as usual, it was a switch mode power supply in there, and there was a capacitor at the top, and you know, you could see where the top of the capacitor can had domed, and then everything had come out of it. And I thought, okay, well, that's kind of bad news. I wonder why that's happened. So we kind of hummed and hard and didn't really know what that was. My girlfriend was there, Christina, who you've met, Kirk. Yeah. Christina is also a broadcast engineer. And so she said, oh, well, there's a parts house in Dublin, which was about maybe a half hour's drive away. They're open today. We could we can get on the internet. We can find out if they've got that particular capacitor in stock. And we can send one of these promotional staff off to this parts house to get a replacement capacitor. So I said, yeah, that's a good idea. So I got my MacBook out, plugged that into the power outlet in the wall, and switched it on, and smoke came out of my power outlet adapter. So then I started thinking, well, okay, something's really badly wrong here. So I go out to the car, come back in with my voltmeter, plugged it into the power outlet, 415 volts was coming out of the domestic outlets in the cabin.
Ouch.
And it turned out that the electricians had wired between two phases rather than wiring between neutral and live. I know it's slightly different the way it's done in the States, but over here we have a neutral and a live connection in the power outlet. And there should be 220 volts across those two, but they'd gone across two phases of the three phase. So there was 440 volts, I think, across it. We eventually did manage to, in fact, to get that capacitor from the parts house, solder it back into the power supply. Of course, it was slightly the wrong size, so it didn't work, and the capacitor had to sit alongside the printed circuit board with two little wire tails joining it onto the PCB, and everything was okay. And I think we got that codec fixed maybe 2 or 3 minutes before the station was on air from there.
See, well, an engineer can be worth his weight in gold. Oh, my goodness. On the chat room, they're saying that really you should have just put the smoke back in.
Yeah, well, that's obviously why the codec wasn't going to work, because the smoke had come out, yeah.
Yeah, we like to say that the parts houses, they put smoke in the parts so that when one of them breaks and fails, you can identify which part failed because all the smoke came out.
Well, it's not just that, Kirk. As we all know, that's how electronic components work. They work by pushing smoke down the little tubes. That's obviously how they work.
See. All right, Chris Tobin, the voice of reason on the podcast. Are you there? Haven't heard from you in a few minutes.
I'm here. No, I've been just entertained listening to the stories of the other two gentlemen. No,
you guys do a lot of remote broadcast with the CBS stations there in New York City. Between all the news gathering that you do and the live talk things that you do and the remotes that the music stations do, surely you've got a story of a pizza being turned upside down on the remote gear or a beer being spilled into it.
Well, let's see. The most recent remote broadcast or outside broadcast we did was this past July 4th. from the deck of a cruise ship docked here in New York City, using a 5.8 microwave link back to the Empire State Building and getting us our IP audio back to the studios. Two radio stations did that. That was an interesting moment, trying to set up a microwave antenna on the deck of a ship where people are running around, jumping into the pools by your side, because we're at they thought it was a great place for the radio station to be, at the aquatic park on the ship. So you can imagine we're surrounded by pools and these huge metal structures that sprayed water for people to walk through. So as the wind shifted from one direction east to west, we were sprayed with water.
As long as you're not using the electronic gear, Chris, I got to tell you, you're going to be just fine.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah, the tabletops were adorned with mixers, microphones, IP codecs. It was an interesting moment. That was this past Sunday. The other outside broadcast time we had a good one was in Times Square, when we were going with the radio microphones, wireless mics, walking around Times Square, Thanksgiving Day parade, and one of the floats strikes a street lamp, taking the street lamp down and striking some pedestrians on the street. Our remote folks were running around. They happened to just be standing by with the radio mics and talking on the radio, and all of a sudden you hear this crashing sound. The next minute, we're on CNN. So that was a fun time. We've had a few other good outside broadcasts that have just been doozies. But those two are the ones that come to mind right away.
Any of you have experience with outside broadcasts? We've been talking about earlier in the show, towers, and the subject kind of switched to outside broadcasts. There's a lot of room for fun and frivolity and mistakes at outside broadcasts, since now you're out there with the public and all sorts of manner of things can happen. What about OB vans or remote trucks, as we call them in the U.S., and the towers that sometimes get put on those? Sometimes a mast made by a company like Wilbert. Maybe a hydraulic mast, or maybe a manual mast on a smaller TV type, a smaller radio truck. You ever have problems or stories about things going wrong there?
I can say that for our broadcasts with the remote vans that use a pneumatic mast to raise the antennas above the truck, we have not had any issues. But I can say that I did have a friend of mine who was working a television remote van. A TV remote pickup, and for some odd reason, they found that one of the drivers decided to move the van just a small amount because they needed to get a better microwave shot. Well, as we all know today, but this goes back, say, 5 years ago, a lot of folks try to be the cowboy, invincible engineer. They say, we can just move the van a little bit. We don't have to take the mast down or bring it down, that is. We'll just move it a little bit. In doing so, they didn't pay attention to the tree that was in front of the van. So as they moved the van, thank God no power lines, they moved the van just 5 feet, the branch they weren't paying attention to knocks into the pneumatic mast and does a nice fine job of bending it down, just making it collapse on its own. And it vertically just goes from a vertical position to horizontal, hitting no one, thank goodness, lands in the parking lot next to the van. So that was a crazy moment. But I can say the radio broadcast, we've been good.
Andy, how about you? You got some OB vans that you deal with there in Ireland?
Oh, yeah. Sadly, I'm afraid there's a few of those about. That Chris's story there about the pneumatic mast reminded me once a long time ago, I was engineering an OB for a radio station which had, a pneumatic mast. It was mounted on the back of a trailer. So you tow the trailer with the station's promotional 4x4. Set it up, and there was a little compressor inside the mast, or inside the trailer, which once you'd climb up a little ladder and pop the antennas onto the top of the mast and go inside and hit a switch, and up it would go. And it had a pressure switch, so that when the mast was fully extended, the compressor would cut out, and then maybe an hour or so later, the pressure would some of the air pressure would leak out, and the compressor would kick back in to make sure the mast stayed up. So I was doing that one day, and so I hit the switch to extend the mast, and went back into the studio inside this trailer to set things up and plug things in, just leaving the compressor running. And I was expecting the compressor to run for maybe I don't know, a minute, as it normally did. Then you'd hear it stop. And when it stopped, you knew that the mast was up and you might go outside and turn it to align the antenna. So I noticed after 3 or 4 minutes that it hadn't stopped. So I thought, okay, well, that's not right. Why is that still running? And when I went outside, of course, the pressure switch had failed. And it had filled up the mast with so much air pressure that one of the collars between two sections of the mast had failed, and the mast had blown itself apart and was laying in two halves, held together only by the cables, which were running up to the antennas. So that was pretty bad news. You know, I had to take that mast down and take it completely to pieces and put all the seals back in and basically rebuild the whole thing, which wasn't really supposed to be part of my day's work that day. The same radio station on another day, I think I'd had a very difficult outside broadcast and I really wanted to go home. So after I'd let the mast collapse just before I was going to drive off to the place where the trailer was stored, I just couldn't be bothered to get up that ladder and take the antennas off the top. I just wanted to go home. So I said, it'll be okay. I'll just drive along with those antennas on top of the mast. They're okay. They're only maybe 6 or 7 feet tall. So that's what I did. Off I drove. Everything was fine. Until I looked down and realized I needed to get some petrol, some gasoline for the vehicle. So I drove into the petrol station and heard a crash. Because, of course, the antennas had crashed into the side of the canopy at the petrol station.
And
made a terrible mess of the side of that canopy. And I just filled up really quickly, then reversed out and drove off.
Do you think they had any security cameras on that? Because if it was a station vehicle, maybe with a logo on the side.
Yeah, that's what I thought afterwards. They won't know it was me. Oh, hang on.
Gee. Hey, Peter, you've got something about a New Year's Eve story I think you were telling me about. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, I better turn my mic up. Oops. I've got a story about, it's only about less than 10 years old, and it's actually won against me. The radio station... I'd been there for a couple of years, and I was in the middle of a major studio renovations, and I wasn't spending as much time at the transmitter as I should be. And then I got on New Year's Eve, which I think from memory was a Saturday. It was a weekend day anyway. New Year's Eve, the main transmitter dropped off. I headed out to the transmitter. We were on the standby was on, so we were on air. Okay, but I headed out to check it all out, and I found that, and it was an Autel Amphet 5 kilowatt, and a fair number of the SCRs and MOSFETs in the rectifier regulator modules for that particular transmitter had seemed to have blown across two of the four modules, and so I'm spending a lot of time on the phone to Nortel trying to figure out why we had this catastrophic failure, and they're getting me to check all kinds of things. What is what it could be, and very helpful as Nortel always are. And between us, we couldn't figure out why all of these components had failed. I guess all I can do is change them. Fortunately, I had plenty of spares. Change them all, and got the transmitter back on air, and I started looking and waiting, and by this time it was about 11 o'clock at night, and then the penny drops. It was New Year's Eve, and that in Australia, that's the middle of summer.
Yeah.
It was a 41 degree day outside, and even at 10 o'clock at night, it was still about 38 degrees, which is 38 degrees is 100 degrees in your numbers. And so it was a 100 plus day all day. It had been 100 plus day all day. And then I checked, these rectifier regulator modules seem to be running really hot. When did I last clean the filters? The filters on the transmitter were all clogged. It's not a, particularly clean site. And so it had allowed the transmitter to overheat, and it had actually blown a whole bag full of parts in the power supplies modules for the transmitter. But the worst part of that night, other than feeling an absolute dill while walking out of the transmitter site, I actually walked out the door, turned on the alarm, I walked out the door and got to my car right on midnight, and there were about three parties going on in the houses adjacent to the transmitter, and everybody's going, "Wee, woo, Happy New Year!" And I'm like, "Oh," and I was feeling a total dill because I'd just put myself through all that agony because I'd been too busy at the studios to get the time to get down to the transmitter and site and do all the routine maintenance like cleaning the filters.
Haven't we all done that? Haven't we all just let something go that should have been paid attention to, and it came back to bite us? And maybe sometimes, you know, the management or ownership or our peers don't find out. We're able to correct the problem, you know, quietly on our own, and hopefully learn something from that. And sometimes, of course, it comes back to bite us publicly.
Yeah, of course, I could just say to the manager, like, "Oh, well, it's an old transmitter, you know, and we got these things happen to our old transmitters. We really need to buy a new transmitter." Yeah.
Well, you know, which did you choose to do, Peter?
How do you mean? Which?
Well, how did you explain the failure to management? Maybe I missed that.
Yeah, I just told them it was an old being an old transmitter, it was about 20 plus years old at the time. And being an old transmitter, you can expect components in it to be to fail.
Okay.
I wasn't going to say it was because I neglected to go out to the transmitter because you've been keeping me so busy with all the things you want me to do in the studios. I decided to avoid that.
You sly dog. Hey, let's see. We're about out of time. We're going to wrap it up pretty quickly here. Chris Tobin's got something about an animal at the transmitter site. I don't think a human animal either. What was it, Chris?
No. I got a call one morning that we were having trouble maintaining our parameters on our directional AM array. And I dial into the remote, check out the readings. Sure enough, they're very erratic, uncertain why. The audio on the air, once in a while you'd hear a pop or a clicking sound, you know, it would sound like static during a thunderstorm. However, the weather was clear skies and everything was good. So I drove out to the transmitter site, got to the building, opened the door, look inside, do the sniff test, nothing burning, visual check, no smoke, still metering the readings on the meters are going all over the place for the directional array. So I decided to take a walk of the towers. We have four towers. So go out, tower one, looks good, open the doors, everything is in order. Tower two, looks good. Get to tower three, and I hear a noise. I hear arcing sounds. And then I hear screeching.
Not barking. Sounds like arcing.
Arcing, I should say, yes.
You heard arcing and screeching.
Arcing and a screeching sound of an animal. Or, you know, you're like, what the? Turns out that a family of rabbits decided to build a little home inside the base of our ATU, the antenna tuning unit, where the coils are for tuning the transmission line to the tower impedance. And as a result, one of the animals decided to reach up to the coil to sit inside a coil to make a little home. So every time it jumped up, it arced and it got thrown against the cabinet. And I guess it did it one, two, three times too many and wound up shorting out the coil, and it was a mess. So
you know,
the
if it was a snake, I wouldn't feel bad about this, but it's a bunny rabbit.
Yeah, it was a mess. It was a mess. I have had snakes do the same thing, and you're right. You're sort of like, okay, you're out of here. But the rabbits, it was just wow. Yeah, it was a weird sound, visually very strange, but just that's one of those things you never forget. So that's my animal story in a tower.
Well, What? Maybe you could have some rabbit for lunch. Bring a bun and some ketchup. Hey, Andy Lynn, you got a quick story to wrap us up and get us out of here. What you got?
Just a small bit of advice. If you ever find yourself with a flat battery in your car and the car won't start, this happened to me. I arrived back in Dublin Airport there a couple of years ago with a colleague. It was 2 o'clock in the morning and the battery in the car was flat, wasn't going to start. So it was that time of the night. We had no jumper cables. What are we going to do? How are we going to get home? We were 2 hours from home. So do you know what we started the car with? The only thing I had in the back of the car that we could use was a 18-volt cordless drill. And I tell you, we just got a couple of bits of patch cord and connected it across the battery, left it 5 minutes, and amazingly enough, it was enough to start the car.
Oh, my gosh. That is some that's some backwoods engineering. An 18-volt cordless drill, so it had an 18-volt battery in it. Yeah, kind of a...
Yeah, it was enough to give a bit, just enough of a charge in that car battery just to turn the engine over.
Wow. Well, speaking of cars and car batteries, I have just one little thing to wrap us up here. Working late one night at a transmitter site, happened to be a big 50,000-watt AM Christian talk station in the mid-south part of the U.S. I and another engineer had been working at the transmitter site quite late, and the transmitter site had a gate at the entrance to it, and then the it was some distance from the gate over to the transmitter building and a little bit of a hill in between, so we wouldn't really have noticed if somebody had come into or out of the gate. Well, it turned out that somebody had come in the gate while we were in the transmitter building working. So my colleague and I got back into my car. We were driving out toward the gate, and our headlights hit upon a car that was pulled over in the weeds. And so I didn't know if the person maybe had a gun, had some ill intent, had just fallen asleep, or just what the deal was. So we sat there for a moment with our headlights shining on this car that was parked in the weeds, and pretty soon various pieces of clothing began floating around. And we could see it in the back window of the car. We saw arms and legs and clothing and such going back and forth inside the car, and very presently the car started up. The reverse lights came on, the car backed out of the weeds and went out the gate. So you never know just what kind of animal you're going to find at your transmitter site. Hey, that's it. We're going to wrap it up for this week in Radio Tech. This has been a War Stories edition. We resume our regular programming next week. We do this once every 10 episodes where we just kind of sit around and have a bull session about odd or unusual things that we've seen at transmitter and studio sites. Hope you've enjoyed this. We have a number of guest suggestions for the weeks coming up, and I appreciate the chat room very much for making these suggestions known to us. Also, you could comment on the website. Go to thisweekinradiotech.com, where you can comment on this show or other shows. You can leave your comments for guests that we should have on the air or subjects that we should cover on This Week in Radio Tech. You can also subscribe to the podcast in the iTunes store. Just do a search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T, in the iTunes store, and you'll find our podcast. There's a couple things called TWIRT. Ours is pretty obvious. And just hit the subscribe button. It's absolutely free. If you've got an iPad or other Apple-type device to play stuff back like that, well, you can get it downloaded automatically. There's also an RSS feed button on the website at thisweekinradiotech.com. And thanks to my friend Bill Meeks, we now have a player built right on the website. You can choose the episode that you want and just click it. It'll play right off the website. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate that. Hey, let's round robin and thank everybody for being here. Chris Tobin, thank you for appearing from New York City, Manhattan.
Oh, you're quite welcome. My pleasure.
And Andy Linton from Ireland, from Waterford, thanks for being with us as well, where it's probably now about 3 in the morning, or 2 anyway.
Yep, just after 2 here. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. I've loved being with you.
Hope you have a good night's sleep tonight, Andy. And Peter Smerden from Melbourne, Australia. Peter, thank you for taking a few minutes out of your day, moving your schedule around so you could be with us on the show.
You're welcome, Kirk. It's been great.
Hope to have you guys back again soon. And thank you for joining us. We look forward to talking to you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another TWIRT has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. Jazz.
This week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged.
If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.